Amen. The title of my sermon this morning is What Motivates You? What Motivates You? I want to talk to you about motivation. How do we examine our motives? The word motivation means the driving force behind your actions or your inactions. My wife, every morning, just about every morning, she does these workout videos in our room, and it puts on she subscribes to this thing and puts on the videos, and she works out, and I sit there and I watch her, and it's a little creepy. And I'm her husband, so it's fine. And I listen to, like, the setup is it has these people working out, and then it has a trainer that's there that's trying to motivate them and showing you how to do the motions and which exercise you're going to do, all that kind of stuff. But it's really interesting to see what they say to try to motivate people. Okay, they'll say things like, come on, press, work hard. This is where you earn that body that when you take your shirt off of the beach, everybody's going to stare, you know? And you know, if you don't believe in yourself, you'll never be able to do it. But you're the only person who's going to change who you're going to be. And if you don't love yourself, no one else is going to love you. And you can make anything happen as long as you believe in yourself. And what's interesting about all these just motivational slogans is they don't know who they're talking to, right? They just are talking to a general audience because anybody could watch these videos. And so they're thinking, what are the general motivations that motivate people? And that's the kind of stuff they're coming up with. You know, as I was thinking about motivation, I was thinking I should go to the king of motivation himself, Tony Robbins. Tony Robbins is probably the largest motivational speaker. In fact, his bio on his website says, Tony Robbins is an entrepreneur, number one New York Times bestselling author, philanthropist, and the nation's number one life and business strategist. He has empowered more than 50 million people from over 100 countries around the world through his audio programs, educational videos, and live seminars. This guy knows a lot about motivation. In fact, one of the things I learned is that the motivational speaking is a $1.9 billion industry here in our country. That's just the speaking. It doesn't include books and all that kind of stuff. And it says on the website that Tony Robbins has identified 13 core motivations that motivate people. Autonomy, mastery, purpose, fear, opposition, competition, necessity, certainty, vision, passion, significance, growth, and contribution. And if you want to know more about those motivations, how to unlock them in your lives, all you have to do is sign up for $500 a month on TonyRobbins.com, and he will teach you how to really be motivated. As you dig into maybe the psychology behind motivation, if you've taken a psychology class in college, no doubt you learned about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. This is a chart that Abraham Maslow came up with in the 1940s, and he said, basically, this helps describe what our motivations are. I think I have a picture of it on the screen. It says our base motivations, they ascend to higher orders, to higher motivations, and we have to fulfill the bottom motivation before we can move on to the next motivation. So he says, first, human beings are motivated by just our physiological needs, sleep, shelter, clothing, food, that kind of stuff. And once we have those met, then we move on to being motivated to safety, to making sure that we live in a safe society or a safe place, and then into love and belonging, and then esteem, and then the highest is self-actualization, where you become the greatest that you actually are, the most important the most important thing that you can become, your self-actualized self. You know, so often with motivations, they're subconscious. We don't think a lot about necessarily what motivates us. And sometimes it's complex and they can be competing motivations in our lives. But just some of the everyday motivations that people tap into are the motivation to get recognition, right? So often if kids do something, their first question is, did you see it? You know, my kids just finished baseball, especially the younger ones. Sometimes they'll be up to bat and they'll get a hit and they'll look and see if their parents saw it before they even run to first base, right? Because they want you to know. The motivation to make more money or to be loved or to prove all the haters wrong or to be the boss or to be happy. We are these big bundles of motivation that are shaped by our upbringing and our experiences and our relationships and our personalities that cause us to do the things that we do. Well, as Christians, as we kind of think on motivations, we think, does God care about what our motivations are? Now, if you've been a Christian for more than 5 minutes, you know the answer to that question is yes. God cares about your motives. He doesn't care only about what you do. He cares about why you do it. Proverbs 16:2 says, all the ways of a man are clean in his own sight, but the Lord weighs the motives. God knows what your motives are, and he weighs them. He says it in another way when God is talking to Samuel, and he's telling Samuel who he wants to be the next king of Israel. He says, bring out all the sons of Jesse. And he starts from the oldest to the youngest, and he goes through all of them, and God says, no, not him. And Samuel's thinking, oh, this one, he looks strong. He looks big. He looks like a great leader. Maybe it's him. And God says, no, it's not him, until he finally gets down to David. And here's what God says to him. He says, God sees not as man sees, but for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. You know, so often we're concerned about what are we presenting to other people? What are we showing other people? What do other people see when they see our actions or the things they see the things we do? But it says that God looks beyond that, and he looks into our hearts. He cares about what's actually going on inside of our hearts. You know, so often in ministry, as you are ministering to people and talking to people, you come into these situations where you got to hold somebody accountable or you got to address something. And a lot of times people will respond, they say, well, God knows my heart. Yeah, he does know your heart. The question is, do you know your heart, right? In fact, it's really difficult for us to even be able to evaluate our own motives sometimes because our hearts are deceitful. It says in Jeremiah 17:9, the heart is more deceitful than all else and is desperately sick. Who can understand it? So often we don't even know our own motives. We don't even know the intentions of our own heart, and yet God sees and weighs those things. He evaluates those things. It says in 1 Corinthians 4:5, wait until the day the Lord comes, who will both bring to light the things hidden in the darkness and disclose the motives of men's hearts. It says that the day is coming when the Lord is going to bring out the truth. You might be able to fool everybody around you, but God knows. Nobody has ever gotten away with one thing in their entire life, because God sees and knows. The Bible says the things done in the darkness are done in broad daylight to God. He sees them for what they are. The Bible says you better be very careful about what your motivations are, because even good things you do with the wrong motives, God knows and he sees. Jesus said this in Matthew 6:1. He said, beware of practicing your righteousness. So this is he's saying, beware of being a righteous person. Beware of doing good things. Beware of being righteous in front of men to be noticed by them, because otherwise you have no reward with your Father who's in heaven. It says you can go walk old ladies across the street and feed the poor and do great deeds, but if you're doing it so that people will see you, that they'll acknowledge you, which we all do, we all want to be seen, we all want to be acknowledged by our fellow human beings. It's an innate instinct we all have, but God says beware of doing it so that other people see you. Because if you do, you have no reward with God. It says in James 4:3 that you can pray with wrong motives. You ask and you do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, so you may spend it on your own pleasures. God, Lord, would you help me in this way? God, would you open this door for me? Would you give me this job? Would you give me this money? Lord, the lotto's at like $150 million. Lord, right now, just give me 6 of the 7 numbers. Now, I don't know what they are. But God sees right through that. He knows. He knows when your heart is to waste it on your own pleasure. It says that he doesn't even answer those prayers. If your motives aren't right in prayer, there's prayers that you can pray that God won't hear. He won't answer. In fact, the Apostle Paul just kind of sums it up in this. Philippians 2:3, he says, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. So many of the things that motivate us are born out of selfishness and vain conceit. They're things that we just want to look good on the outside, or we want people to be happy with us, or we want to make more money, or we want esteem, we want to be loved. We want to be fulfilled. Just something like this. It's all this kind of stuff. And the Apostle Paul says, do nothing from those motivations. And yet so many of the motivations that we get are those kind of motivations. There's a famous theologian, Dr. Peter Jones. He actually was a seminary professor up here at Westminster in Escondido, Westminster Seminary. And he's well known. He coined these two terms, oneism and twoism. And it's actually a really helpful way of thinking about the world. These are kind of a meta-philosophy. He's saying that all worldviews, all religions fall under one of two categories, either oneism or twoism. Oneism, he says, is the idea that in essence, all things are one. that everything has basically the same parts and the same essence. And so this would be like the Hindu belief, the Hindu philosophy that everything we do is one, and we want to reach enlightenment. We reduce our own self and we become just a part of the universe, basically. Okay? And we think about that's kind of an Eastern philosophy, but it's also the same philosophy that's going on in evolutionary materialism, right? The idea that we're just all star particles. We're just all atoms. We're just all material bouncing across. And that's all everything that exists is. That's the idea in oneism, but Christianity teaches twoism. Christianity teaches that, yes, all things that we see in substance, they do have a similar essence, but there's something else outside of that. There's a creator who's outside and distinct from the creation. And that the creator interacts with the creation, but he's not the same as us. He's different than us. The way that Peter Jones described it, he says, oneism is that all is one. We worship and serve creation as divine. All distinctions must be eliminated. Through enlightenment, we discover that we also are divine. Twoism is different. Twoism is all is two. We worship and serve the eternal personal creator outside of us, of all things. That God alone is divine and distinct from his creation, and yet through his son Jesus, he is in loving communion with his creation. That's the Christian worldview. But so many things, when we talk about motivation, so many of our motives are derived from oneism. Dig deep within yourself. Find your meaning. What are your values? Live faithfully according to your values. That's oneism. Peter Jones uses this one verse in the Bible to describe what that is. It's Romans 1:25. It says, for they exchanged the truth, say truth, the truth of God for a lie, say a lie, and worshiped and served the creature, say creature, rather than the creator, say creator, who is blessed forever, amen. It says that this is, in this one verse, we have this idea explained of oneism and twoism. That there are people who forsook the worship of the creator, which is true worship, to worship the created, which the Bible calls a lie, right? And so when we get into this idea of, man, as we're searching through our motives, all these motives, so much of what passes for what is good motivation to achieve in your life and to accomplish big things, is actually just a lie. It's false worship. It's worshiping the creation rather than the creator. And so if that's how we should understand, you know, all this motivation, then what should our motivation be? As Christians, what does the Bible teach our motivation to be? I would like to look at what the Apostle Paul says his motivation is. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 14, this is going to be our main text this morning. 2 Corinthians 5:14, it says, for the love of Christ controls us. Having concluded this, that one died for all, therefore all died. I want to zoom in on the first part of that verse. For the love of Christ controls us. It's the love of Christ that controls us. It's the love of Christ that should be our motivation. Now, what's interesting about this verse is in English, you can actually read it two ways. In Greek, you can read it two ways too. It has two possible meanings. It can either mean that God's love for us controls us, or it can mean our love for God controls us. Now, it's not exactly clear, and I wonder if that's intentional. I wonder if the Apostle Paul put it there, because there's some truth in both of those things. But if we're going to pick a meaning, I think the dominant meaning is that God's love for us controls us. And the reason is you look what Paul teaches in the scriptures. In Ephesians chapter 3, the Apostle Paul says, he's teaching the Ephesians, and he says, I want to explain what my prayers for you are. And he says, this is my prayer. Let's look. Starting in verse 14. For this reason, I bow my knees before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth derives its names, that he would grant you, according to the riches of his glory, to be strengthened with power through his Spirit in the inner man, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, and that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may be able to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth, and to know the love of Christ, which surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled up to all the fullness of God. The Apostle Paul says that I pray for you, that you might be rooted and grounded in love, that you actually might grow in your understanding of what is the height and depth and width and length of the love of Christ. in your life? And then he says something that's kind of shocking. He says that you may know that which is unknowable. Because here's part of the truth about the love of God is we could wax poetic here this morning. And we could talk about, you know, try to take our limited language and apply it to the love of Christ, but there's something that's just going to fail about that. And so the Apostle Paul here says, I'm just praying that God would reveal it to you, that he would show you deeper, wider, longer, higher, how great his love is for you. In fact, this is God's love is so profound, it's so deep, it's so all-encompassing that we're going to spend millions and millions of years just digging into it and having that mystery revealed to us in deeper and deeper ways. 10 billion years from now, you're still going to be pulling on that string. You're still going to be blown away by this powerful love of God. And the reason is because, man, there is nothing to compare it to. The things he gives us to compare it to, the love of a father, or the love of a mother, is just like a snapshot compared to what the real thing is from God. Or you know, if you've ever been desperately in love with someone, a husband or a wife, or you've just been fully in love, it's just a Polaroid picture compared to the real thing. Because God's love is so profound, it is so deep. And so I'm not going to try to wax poetic about it. I'm just going to pray that this morning that God would give us a revelation of his love. Apostle Paul said that that's my motivation. It's the love of Christ that controls me. It's his love that is the reason I do what I do. There's another challenge with this verse, though. It's that word controls. The love of Christ controls me. One of the problems is you're going to run into is when we're reading the Bible, we're reading English translations, almost all of us, are reading an English translation of the original language, which is Hebrew or Aramaic or Greek, okay? And so what we in the English language, we have about 50 probably good translations. And part of the reason there's so many translations is because language changes over time, right? So you have the King James Version that is Old English, and the language is archaic, and it's anachronistic, and it's hard for us to understand. But then we have more modern translations, and then there's translations that try to put it in, make it easier to read, you know, for maybe a fifth grade level or a 12th grade level or something like that. There's different versions. Here at the church, we use the NASB 1995 version. They recently came out with a newer version. We like the 1995 version, and so we just stick with that one. But there's lots of good translations. But what's interesting about this verse is when you go through and read it, you read that, like we read in the NASB, it says the love of Christ controls you. The NASB says that, the ESV says that, the Lexham English Bible, the New Century Translation, the NLT, the New International Reader's Version, all say the love of Christ controls us. But if you go to the King James Version, it says the love of Christ constraineth us. Now you see why we don't use the King James Version. But that word constrain is a different word than controls. And modern translations like the American Standard Version, the Darby Bible, the Hebrew Names Version, the Jubilee Bible all say the love of Christ constrains us. But it's even more challenging when you go to the NIV because it says the love of Christ compels us. Now, compels and controls and constrains are all three different words. It's them translating this Greek word, synecho, into an English word. And so when the translators come to it, they have to try to pick which word in the English language best explains this word in the Greek. And so Bible translators have come up with these three different words. And the reason is because this word has three dominant meanings. It's a very peculiar word. It's a very different word. It has three dominant meanings. I want to look at what those three meanings are because I think all three of those definitions are intended here when the Apostle Paul says that his motivation is the love of Christ controls him or compels him or constrains him. Let's look at those three definitions. The first is this, is that word compel. That the love of Christ will compel you, will move you forward, will push you into some things. It's going to push you towards things. It's going to urge you on. It's going to impel you. God's love for you is going to impel you to do things in your life, to make certain choices. Primarily among those, it's going to compel you to go deeper into God. Higher up, higher in, to press you, to push you to seek after God, to try to understand him in a deeper way, to try to understand his love, the height, the breadth, the width, the depth, that which is unknowable, to seek after him. But it's going to push you to do other things too. It's going to push you to die to yourself and live to him. It's going to push you to forgive the person who grievously sinned against you. It's the love of Christ working in you that pushes you out of your comfort zone into some kind of ministry, to take a step of faith or to seek his face. It'll push you to look beyond someone's rough exterior to see what God sees. Or maybe through their shallow presentation, what they're presenting to the world, it will push you beyond that to see what it is the Lord is doing in that person's life. The love of Christ will compel you to open your home, maybe to a kid who needs help, or maybe to a single mom, to get involved in a situation that, man, it would be so much easier to stay out of it. Somebody else's messiness is just going to complicate your life and make your life messy. But it's the love of Christ working in you that causes you to see something different, that causes you to step up, to speak out. Last week, we looked at how the gospel spread throughout the earth. We looked about how the love of Christ compelled people to leave their families, to leave their friends, to leave their jobs and situations, to go to a foreign people, to traverse oceans and go into scary situations in order to share the love of Christ. And that's happened over and over and over and over again for 2,000 years. You know, they used to send missionaries away, and a lot of times when they send missionaries, this is when travel was not as easy. If we send somebody to Africa, we can buy them a plane ticket and have them back. When travel was a lot more dangerous than that, they used to pack people, missionaries' belongings. When they go to the mission field, they used to pack them in their caskets. That's how you would travel. And there's something intentional about that. I'm sure you could have gotten a casket somewhere else, right? But they wanted to be, man, you are giving your life to this. There's no going back from this. And so these people would, it was clear you were giving everything. The love of Christ was compelling you. You know, I was thinking about where we live. And the first people who brought the gospel here, we have these missions here. That's our oldest, you know, kind of history. And they were built by people who came here to share the gospel. The primary Franciscan monk who was responsible for all the missions through Baja and up through Southern California, all the way up to San Francisco, was Junipero Serra. And if you know, we had Serra High School just a few years ago. They changed their name. Because as they look back at his writings and his testimony, they found some things that were kind of problematic, as they do about anybody they look at in history. But honestly, it's a foolish thing to do, because if you look, this man was a hero of the faith. You think about what caused the conquistadors to come over here. What was it? It was the promise of gold and silver and riches and land. But there was another group of people that came over with them, these Franciscan monks. And what was their goal? It wasn't gold and silver. In fact, they had taken vows of poverty. When Junipero Serra came here, when he landed by the Yucatan, he walked because they didn't ride horses. And I'm pretty sure they also didn't wear shoes. And these monks who had given their life to the gospel, who had come here, he walked all the way from Yucatan to Mexico City. And he got a really bad bug bite that turned into a terrible infection that caused his leg to be debilitated for the rest of his life. He was severely disabled. It was incredibly painful and incredibly hard for him to walk. And yet it was the love of Christ for the indigenous people who lived here that he wanted to share the gospel with these people. They caused him to leave Mexico City and walk all the way up to Baja, all the way up Baja, and all the way up to establishing these missions along the way. San Diego and Carmel and all the places, all the way up to San Francisco. And it was the idea that, man, there are people who are dying outside of Christ and they don't know the gospel. And so it compelled him, it pushed him, the love of God inside of him, working in him, to go to extreme lengths. The love of Christ will push you towards sacrifice and generosity and obedience. It's the love of Christ that will cause you to stand up for the truth and protect the vulnerable. It's Christ's saving love inside of us, that he was willing to go to the cross, he was willing to sacrifice his life, that he knew us, that he formed us, and that he chose us and wanted us. That causes us to go and to be pushed forward. It's Christ-saving love that should animate our lives, that can compel us to live our lives, not the pursuit of the American dream, not towards some worldly measure of success, but toward a life lived as an offering to him, because he so loved us. So that's the love of Christ will move you forward, but it also says the love of Christ will constrain you. Constrain you is almost the opposite of compel you. To constrain means to be held back. The love of Christ will hold you back. You know, there's going to be things in this life, options that are going to present themselves that because of the love of Christ as your motivating factor is going to keep you from saying yes to that. It's going to stop you from reaching out your hand and touching it. The love of Christ is one of the things that compels us to resist sin, to resist temptation, to resist these internal desires we have that are contrary to Christ. This is what Joseph was when he was when Potiphar's wife tried to seduce him. He was presented with this opportunity, and what does he say? He says, "Far be it from me to sin against my God. May it never be." It was Christ's love working in him that said, "No way. I'm not going to touch that which God would not have me touch." It's the love of Christ that keeps us from the profane. But it's not just the profane. It's not just things that would be wrong or sinful. It's other things that would just be distracting. That would take our mind and focus off of the things that God has put in front of us and put us on other things. Right? It's the love of Christ that keeps us from getting too into our career or too into sports or, you know, too into on our phones all the time. It's the love of Christ that would keep us from settling for something else that's not fully of him. 2 Timothy 2:4 says, "No soldier in active service entangles himself in the affairs of everyday life so that he may please the one who enlisted him as a soldier." It's the love of Christ that will hold you back in some of those situations from getting involved in just the drama of this world or the short-sightedness of this world. To keep our hearts and minds set apart for him. There's a story about an Anabaptist in Holland in the 1500s, Dirk Willems. This is during the Protestant Reformation where there was a huge conflict between Catholicism and the Reformation, and he was an Anabaptist. One of the things Anabaptists believe is that they practice believer's baptism. It's what we practice here at this church. So we don't baptize babies. We wait until you're old enough to make your own profession of faith, and then we baptize you. Well, Catholicism baptizes babies, and so there was all these people who had been baptized as babies, but they maybe weren't born again. Maybe they didn't really have true saving faith, and as he ministered and loved on people, there were people who gave their lives to the Lord, and they wanted to be baptized, and so he baptized. He baptized some of the people in his own home, and he baptized some of his friends. That was a crime at that time, and so he was arrested, and he was tortured, and he was beaten. He was starved. He was put on prisoner rations, and he actually had him in this old palace that they had turned into a prison, and there's a giant moat around this palace. And one winter, he just said, "I've had enough." And so he fashioned together this rope out of cloth. He was able to lower himself down from one of the upper windows, and he began to run away. And there was a guard who saw him and began to chase him. As he ran across the moat, he was so amazed that he was so light that he could run across. But when the guard passed across, he fell into the ice. And as he turned around, he heard this guard screaming for help. He knew he was going to die without his help. And so Willems turned around. And he went and rescued this guard who was chasing him. He was rearrested, and 4 days later, he was burned at the stake. The Bible says, not the Bible, history, church history says that the wind shifted as he was burning. It began to blow away from him, so it ended up being this really slow burn. It took him like 40 minutes to die. And he just began to cry out for God's mercy, and it says that his screams and his praises could be heard for miles around. But you ask yourself, what is the motivation? What would have compelled Willems to turn back? Because here's what we know it's not. We knew Willems wanted to live. That's why he escaped. We knew he longed for the comfort of his family to return to the ministry that God had given him. He knew he had a clear conscience. He had not done anything guilty of being put to death. He was wrongly accused of a sin, of a crime. He knew what he was doing was right. He knew he didn't deserve to be punished and put to death. And so the only thing standing between him and freedom was this guard falling through the ice. It says he turned around and saved him. What is it that caused Willems, what motivated Willems to turn back? It was the love of Christ. It was God's command, love your enemies. Do good to those who persecute you. And so here's this man whose life is in peril, and now Willems, it almost could be his opportunity to get what he wants, what his freedom is, and yet it's the love of Christ that compels him to go back. It's the love of Christ that constrains us, that keeps us from focusing and doing the things that we want to do, our agenda, accomplishing what we want to do, and focuses us on God's agenda. So the love of Christ will push you forward. It will compel you, but it will also hold you back. But the third thing it says, where Paul says the love of Christ controls us, means that the love of Christ will keep you in some things. It will keep you doing some things that, given your, apart from the motivation of Christ, you would have given up on a long time ago. It will keep you in his grace. It will keep you walking by faith. It will keep you in the church. Listen, I say it a lot, but, and I probably don't need to say it again, but there's some new people here. Everybody else knows this. If you stick around here for very long, somebody's going to hurt you bad. Okay? And that's just because, man, this church is full of people. Somebody's going to see something different than you see. They're going to have a different perspective. Something is going to happen that is going to really offend you and really hurt you. Some of you guys are here at this church because at some other church, you got hurt and offended. And we're all faced with this time, man, am I going to give up? Am I going to quit? I can't tell you how many times over the years that I felt discouraged, disillusioned. I just wanted to give up. Just move somewhere else, be somebody else. We all fight discouragement. We all have to encounter at some point our own failings. We're all going to be affected by the failings of others. We go through periods of disillusionment and frustration. And the question then is going to be, what is your real motivation? What is it that really is motivating you in your life? What's at the core of it? Is it to be well thought of? Is it to be liked? Is it to be loved? You know, what I'm doing up here right now is like a really spiritual thing, okay? Like I'm preaching the gospel. And as a minister, as a Christian, my heart is like, God, I want to be pleasing to you. Lord, I want to preach in such a way that I know your pleasure and I know your affirmation. Lord, I want to feed your sheep. Lord, I want to obey you and the calling you have on my life. And there's another part of me that wants you to really like what I'm doing up here. Like there's another part of me, there's another motivation in there that you know, after service when you come up, you go, wow. You know, I mean, wow, you know. Those other guys, they're okay. But you know, and okay, so that's a dangerous motivation. That's a dangerous motivation, and all of us have these mixed motives, right? And sometimes I think it's God's grace to us that he takes away some of the other motivations. In fact, one of the reasons we go through hard things, one of the reasons that we go through disappointments and discouragements, because it's God refining and purifying us. Why are you really doing it? What's your true motivation? And so sometimes those things that hurt the most are actually God's blessing to us in order to sanctify us and refine us. It's him saying, when we take away everything else, we take away all the other eyes, we take away all the other good jobs, nobody's going to see this, nobody's going to hear about it, nobody's going to think it's good. Now why are you doing it? I want to invite the band up here. Because God knows the only real, life-giving, true motivation is that the love of Christ in our life would compel us, would push us forward, would cause us to move into those things that God has called us into, and that the love of Christ would also constrain us from things that aren't for us, would keep us from walking in sin, would keep us from pursuing other things so that we could be single-minded and pure-hearted. And that the love of Christ will keep us doing some things that we would have stopped doing a long time ago if it wasn't for the love of Christ holding fast to us, keeping us on the right path, keeping us committed to the right direction in our lives. I love what part in the Bible when Jesus had these huge crowds were following him is probably the peak of his popularity. He had fed the 5,000. He had fed the 4,000. He'd done all these miracles, and all these people were coming out from the countryside to just see and hear about him. We're falling around. We're camping out. It was this big festival. And Jesus thought, I don't like that. I don't like that because this seems like shallow to me. I don't know what your motivations are. And so the Bible says he began to preach hard things. He began to talk about sacrifice, and he began to preach on suffering. He began to preach the cross, and he began to prophesy about what was going to happen to him. That he was going to Jerusalem, he was going to die and be crucified. He began to talk about, you have to drink my blood, you have to eat my flesh. Confusing things, things that people found offensive, they didn't understand. And it says that people began to leave. That's not what they came out for. That wasn't what they were motivated by. And then there's this profound moment when he turns to the disciples and he says, they're leaving. Are you going to leave too? Basically like, hey, now's your opportunity. And Peter says this thing that for me sums up so much of what it is to follow Jesus. It's in John 6:68. It says, Simon Peter answered him and said, Lord, to whom shall we go? You are the one with words of eternal life. His answer is just simple. He just says, I don't have anywhere else to go. You're the only one who has loved me with this kind of love. Every other fount is going to run dry. Every other thing is going to stop short. Every other motivation will fail you. Yet it's the love of Christ driving inside of me. It's this love of Christ that is constantly being renewed and poured out to me, that is constantly amazing me, that is constantly I'm finding new parts of it, new ways that God has been faithful to me, new ways that he's loved my soul that have just is my motivation for my life and for what I'm choosing and who I'm going to be. That's the real motivation. And Peter says, so you're the only one who has that. So I don't, all my other options are gone. I'm just convinced of that. Let's stand, let's worship the one who's loved us so well.